And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thank you for being with me today. I love our time together, and I'm looking forward to it. I want to start with a passage that I love from Psalm 119, verse 18. It says, "Open my eyes that I may see wonderful things in your law." I'm really looking forward to the show today, as I do every day. Nate Pyle is going to be joining me in just a little bit. And then Paul Kengor, Dr. Paul Kengor from Grove City College is going to be joining me. We're going to be talking a little bit about what's going on in our country with discussions of things like capitalism and socialism. And then David Miles is going to be in studio. And David is a pastor here in New Hope. And this is some good thinking going on in his brain. So I'm looking forward to today. And I'm so glad that we can have this time together. I'm singing. I can't sing. Rebecca's looking at me like I've lost my mind, but some days I have. So we'll take a little break, and then we'll be back with Nate Pyle. Welcome back to the show. I have on my guest line, Nate Pyle. You've written a book called More Than You Can Handle, When Life's Overwhelming Pain Meets God's Overwhelming Grace. You know, I love this because, you know, we've heard that expression ad nauseum, that God won't give you more than you can handle. And it doesn't seem to be very helpful. And it doesn't even seem to be terribly biblical. So I'm going to cry out, Nate, help us, help us, help us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, it is a very common phrase. And I think that when people say it to those who are going through difficult circumstances, that they mean it with well intentions, and they mean it to be a source of comfort. But the truth of the matter is, as you say, it's not biblical at all. It sounds biblical,
it
and
does.
Some can point to a passage. You know, you can point to 1 Corinthians 10, and there Paul talks about not being tempted beyond that which you can endure, and that's how it got twisted into, or that's where it came from. But it got twisted into this: God won't give you more than you can handle. The problem with that phrase, though, is what it implies is that you are the one that has to handle whatever it is that you're going through, right? So no matter what the circumstances, you can handle it. So you should handle it. You should be strong enough. Your faith should be secure enough. You should not have any problem. I mean, you may have to struggle a little bit, but ultimately, you're the one who has to handle it. And what we know from the rest of the Bible is that ultimately, we ought to rely on God. And when we are weak, we rely on Christ's strength. And so this phrase becomes very problematic because it actually keeps us from ever being weak. And if we feel weak, then we feel that something's wrong with us, that God has given us something and we're not up to the challenge. And that's just not the way that God operates.
Yeah, great angle on that, Nate. So why were you interested in addressing this problem, you, Nate Pyle?
Yeah, so for one, as a pastor, I've heard this phrase either uttered by people who are going through difficult circumstances, or I've heard it for others. But more than that, my wife and I, we went through a period where we were struggling with infertility, and we did all the testing and were frustrated by the lack of answers that we were getting from medical professionals about why we couldn't get pregnant. And then my wife did end up getting pregnant, and at the same time that she got pregnant, she felt like something wasn't right. We went in, had some tests done by the doctors, and what we heard was that there was a possibility that this was an ectopic pregnancy. And so we asked very, very candidly to the doctor, you know, are you sure it's an ectopic pregnancy? And for those who don't know, an ectopic pregnancy is when the embryo doesn't get implanted in the uterine wall. It's in the fallopian tubes. And so we asked the doctor if they were sure, and they said, no, it's so early in the pregnancy, there's no way we can be sure, but we are recommending that you terminate this pregnancy. And for my wife and I and our values, we that was not an option. And so we ended up waiting to see until we could get to more clarity. And then within a couple of days, my wife started experiencing some intense pain and bleeding. And then we went back in to the emergency room, and they were able to confirm that it was an ectopic pregnancy. And at that point, we had to end it. And that just started this line of questioning and wondering for me. I mean, here's the thing we've been praying for and longing for, and it seems like it's about to happen. And just as our hopes get raised a little bit, the rug gets pulled out from underneath us, and now we're in a position where we're ending a pregnancy. And so just asking God, where are you in this, and why is this happening? And the pain that we were feeling both in our questions and just the emotional roller coaster that we had been on just really did feel like it was more than we could handle. As I went to the scriptures in the midst of that, it became very clear, like God maybe doesn't give us more than we can handle, but certainly allows more than we can handle at times. And I found in one particular passage, Paul, you know, the great Paul, who has all the faith in the world and who can sing hymns in the midst of being in prison, Paul writes that they endured so many hardships that they despaired of life itself. And he said that and then turned around and said, and yet we were able to rely on Christ in that moment. And that's in 2 Corinthians. And when I read that, I went, oh, that's actually very comforting to know that someone like Paul even felt that overwhelmed by life.
Wow. My heart is heavy for what you and your wife went through, Nate. So sorry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, as we've been sharing that story, we find so many people are also struggle with infertility, and so many do it quietly. So part of even why I wrote this book was to come alongside of those and give them a conversation partner and maybe even the courage to share with other people what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. And just for our listeners to help understand what you and your wife did, the fertilized egg never took hold in the uterus. And it lived in the fallopian tube. So there was never a chance of this migrating into the uterus, was it?
No, there was never a chance it would migrate into the uterus. And at that point, it's not a viable pregnancy. It would either burst in the fallopian tubes and cause my wife to die and or bleed out and have serious damage. So she'd have to have surgery and all of that. And in the meantime, the embryo itself would never be viable.
So it just, when I hear a pastor say, then we had to end the pregnancy, I think that's what you said. I just wanted to just backtrack a little bit and say
thank you for doing that. Yeah. And that was the heart-wrenching decision for us, because we very much, and when the doctor said, well, no, we can't be sure, it was for us like, well, we can't in good faith then continue on, knowing that it would still be a risk to my wife just because of how these things progress. But it became a point where, she was experiencing pain and at risk of having the fallopian tubes burst, and the pregnancy itself at that point was not viable at all.
Yeah.
And so that's what we had to do.
Nate, what did this teach you about yourself?
Well, it really revealed to me the. I would almost use the word pride, the pride that I have in being able to control situations and fix situations. I'm very much a guy who, you know, if my dishwasher breaks, I'm going to figure out how to fix it. And I'm going to get on YouTube and you know, watch some videos and then figure out if I can do it. You know, I like to fix situations. I want to be someone who is in control. And what this really revealed to me is that I'm not in control, that there's a lot that I have no ability to change here in this world. And I really do need to rely on Jesus and be willing to step back from trying to fix it and simply trust that in the midst of whatever it is that I'm facing, that God's going to meet me, that God's going to work in some capacity, even though I may not understand it or see it right away, but that God is going to work. And so it really revealed to me the deep desire that I have to be someone who can, quote unquote, handle everything.
Yeah. In your book, Nate, you said faith is not certainty. Treating faith as certainty leaves us anxious and exhausted in our pursuit to prove we have enough faith. Talk more about that, would you?
Yeah, I think that sometimes we have an operational belief or a way of operating within our faith, where we treat faith as if it is certainty, as if it is something that we are beyond a shadow of a doubt convinced of to the degree that that certainty makes things happen, right? So if I have enough faith, then God will respond in a positive manner. If I have enough faith, then I'll get to see the healing that I'm longing for. If I have enough faith, then whatever circumstance I'm facing will be fixed. And that pursuit is what leaves us anxious, because if we don't get the healing that we are after, if a situation goes unresolved, if a relationship isn't reconciled, then we're left wondering, well, do I have enough faith? Was I not convinced enough? Did too many doubts pop up? And when we find ourselves in this place where we have a very transactional relationship with God, I'll give you a belief that without any doubt, and you'll give me good blessings. And that's not how God works. That's not how grace works. Faith is a gift itself, and even in those moments where we have doubts and we have questions, God doesn't cast us off, but rather God meets us there. God is the God of doubting Thomas, right? I need to touch you. And so Jesus holds out his hands, or the man whose child is suffering, and he says, I do believe, but help me in my unbelief, right? That unbelief doesn't somehow keep God from us, but we can become. I think we have this operational belief that says, yeah, I do. I need to have enough faith in order for God to respond to my prayers.
Yeah. Nate, when we look at our own pain, do we do comparative analysis to other people's pain and suffering?
I think we absolutely do comparative analysis. I know that even in writing this book, my wife and I, we went through this difficult situation, and it was truly difficult, and it was painful, and it caused a lot of questions. And I would look at other people and say, well, I shouldn't really be writing this book because so-and-so suffered more, or other people maybe have actually had held their child and the child passed away. And that's, and so we do these things where we compare our sufferings to another person's, and then we gauge it on some scale to see if, do I have enough suffering? Have I suffered enough to actually talk about this in some way or to bring it up? And that comparison can almost be, it can rob us of compassion, both of showing compassion by thinking, well, I've suffered more than they have, so I'm not going to give them any compassion. Or it can rob us of compassion in that we don't share how we're in pain, and we don't share what's going on with us, and we inhibit others from being able to comfort us in ways that we need to be comforted.
I'm going to take a little break. I'm speaking to Nate Pyle. He's written a book called More Than You Can Handle: When Life's Overwhelming Pain Meets God's Overwhelming Grace. Nate serves as a pastor of Christ Community Church in Fishers, Indiana. He's the author of Man Enough and blogs regularly at natepyle.com. We'll take a short break and be back in 90 seconds. Welcome back to the show. I have on our guest line Nate Pyle, and he's written a great book called More Than You Can Handle: When Life's Overwhelming Pain Meets God's Overwhelming Grace. And I know, Nate, the Bible is so filled with lamenting. I don't know if we do lamenting very well in the 21st century.
Yeah, I don't think that we do lament well. It's certainly something that I didn't grow up learning about. I grew up in the church and heard very little about lament. And it's only been within the last 4 or 5 years that I've really pressed into this idea of lament and tried to explore it. And so I think we have to contrast lament with the triumphalism that we feel we ought to experience, right? We believe as Christians that we have victory in Jesus, and that's absolutely true. And that victory is not yet fully realized. And I think that sometimes we feel bad about saying that there are areas of our life where we haven't yet experienced that victory. But that's exactly what lament does. Lament is honest about those parts of our lives that are broken, about the parts of our lives that are not yet healed, those places in our lives where the promises of God have not been fully realized. And so when we look through the Bible, we see raw human emotion expressed throughout the Psalms and throughout the book of Lamentations, and especially in the book of Job. One of my favorite lines in the book of Job has experienced all of this tragedy between losing his children and losing his wealth and even his health. And he's crying out to God, and he's asking God, why did this happen to me? And he's wondering about how God works and how he operates in the world. And there's a line where Job says, I stand here, and all you do is look at me. And I think that's something that we can all relate to, that we know that God can see us, that God can see all that's happening in the world, and yet it seems like God is choosing not to act on our behalf, choosing not to step in and fix that situation. And lament is acknowledging that pain that we feel, acknowledging that frustration we feel, because we so believe in the promises of God, right? We believe that God heals, we believe that God restores, we believe that God has promised to comfort those who mourn, and when it seems like he's not, lament is the act of saying, God, these are your promises, and I've yet to experience their fulfillment in my life, and I'm waiting, trusting, and holding you responsible to actually fulfilling these promises. And that's a really powerful kind of prayer to pray. It's the prayer where we bring all of who we are, all of our emotion, all of our experience to all of who God is in a relationship of trust. And then there's some waiting that's involved, to wait to see how God responds.
I'm looking at the cover of your book, Nate, and the name of the book is More Than You Can Handle, and it's a picture of a piece of rope that's separated only to be held together by one single thread. And I'm wondering if you're at that place and you're absolutely beside yourself and you feel like you've got more than you can handle, and now you've got to pray to God, but you're too angry to pray to God, what do you do?
That is great. And this is where I'd point to the line of Ecclesiastes, right, where it talks about a single cord is easily broken, but a three-strand cord is not. That this is the role of the church, that when we are unable to pray, that we have brothers and sisters who come alongside of us and they pray on our behalf. When our faith, and when it's difficult for us to believe, that others would believe on our behalf. This is the picture of Moses, and you know, Joshua's down fighting the battle, and Moses, as long as his arms are being held up in the air, Joshua is winning. But when his arms get tired and fatigued and they begin to go down, then the battle begins to go the other direction. And so Moses has people come around him and hold his arms up. I think this is the picture of faith for us. And so this is why we need the church. This is why we need to be a part of a community that makes it safe for us to express our doubts and our questions and our sufferings and our pains and all of that. It's so that we have a community of people who can pray on our behalf when maybe we're too angry, or maybe we don't have words, or maybe we've said all the words that we have and we have nothing else to say. Mm-hmm. Well, then our brothers and sisters can come alongside of us and pray some more for us.
I know one of the things I think about every time I come into the studio to host a show is I know that most, if not all, listeners have got some level of suffering that they're going through on their plate. And I have such compassion for people wherever they're at in their place in life. So you're talking about, you know, more than you can handle, and you've had a lot of stories of people suffering. Is there some hope for them, or some words of encouragement if they're in that place?
I think one of the hopes that we can have is that, one, suffering is the common human experience. As you say, every listener has some kind of suffering that's going on, right? It's the thing that unites us. And the God whom we love and the God who loves us is the God who took on human flesh and who entered into the full human experience, which included the common human experience of suffering. And so God in Jesus suffered hunger pains, suffered betrayal, suffered tired legs at the end of a long day, suffered humiliation, and suffered death on the cross. And so one place that we can find hope is in Jesus himself. The other place that we can find hope is in Jesus' body on earth in its current form, which is the church. I think, again, of Paul's words to the Corinthians when he says, in the same way that you have been comforted, so comfort others. If suffering is the common human experience, and if all of us have experienced some kind of comfort in the midst of those experiences, then we have what we need to be able to offer comfort to others, even if that is simply this quiet presence of being with somebody. And, you know, I think of so many people in my congregation who I know over the years have gone into emergency rooms for some procedure and unexpectedly. And for their loved ones to not sit alone in the emergency room is a kind of grace, is the presence of Jesus in those places. And so there is hope. There is hope in Jesus. There is hope in the body of Christ. And there's hope in the comfort that the Holy Spirit supernaturally gives to people.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm almost out of time, Nate. So this is my half-court shot at the buzzer for you to answer. Some things, the truth is some things really just don't make sense, and they never will.
Yep.
So do you have a little piece of wisdom or advice for those listeners living with those facts?
I don't. And,
okay.
And one of the things that I've found, and one of the things that I find that's difficult as someone who, I majored in chemistry when I was in college, so I like explanations. One of the things that's true is that the Bible offers no explanation to suffering, to evil and injustice in the world. It doesn't seem that God is interested in providing us an answer and never promises to give us an explanation. What God does promise us is that he will be with us, Emmanuel, God with us. God promises that one day every tear will be wiped from every eye. Doesn't promise that we will know. We hope that we will know. We hope that we will. It will make sense. But even in that, what we're promised is that God will make all things new, and will make all things beautiful, and will wipe away the tears that we are crying even now.
That is a happy note to end on, Nate. Thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Nate Pyle has been my guest, and his book is called More Than You Can Handle, When Life's Overwhelming Pain Meets God's Overwhelming Grace. Now we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm always delighted to talk to Dr. Paul Kengor. He's an author and professor of political science at Grove City College, and he is an expert on so many things. He's written many books. He wrote a book on the Pope and the President. I could go on and on about all of his books. I will find them in just a minute and regale them for you, but right now he's on our studio line. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Hey, Bill. Good. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, it's come up time and time again on the show, and every time the idea comes up of the direction of where our country is headed, or how interested people are in the idea of socialism, I really don't want to put my foot in that pond, because it's a dicey pond, let me tell you. So I bring in people like you to talk about it.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, and it's something that people like myself have been talking about for a long time, and we've also been warning people since really the end of the Cold War, that if we don't teach our children what communism is, what socialism is, the differences in the two, the similarities in the two, if we don't teach them this, it's going to come back to bite us.
Yeah.
And you know, we won the Cold War. We won it on the battlefield, but we're losing this battle in the classroom, where because of the sins of omission, what we've failed to teach our youth.
Yeah, Paul, please say more about that, because, you know, I read an article this morning on millennials have so much college debt they can't afford to buy a new car or eat out, and everyone is so stressed. So when you wave around free tuition or we're going to just take away your student debt, that gets them awfully excited.
Yes, and imagine that. So we send our kids off to college so they can get mountains of debt and learn that socialism is good, right? I mean, what kind of a bargain is that?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and not to mention that they can go and choose, you know, according to Facebook, one among 71 different gender options that they can also learn about at college. So yeah, that's what they're learning. And yeah, I say this to people all the time, and I've said it on this show before as well. You know, people, please, please, please be careful about where you send your kids to school.
Mm-hmm.
And for a Christian audience as well, you know, just because that college has the word Christian somewhere in the charter or somewhere in the mission statement, or actually it might not even be in the mission statement nowadays, or maybe, you know, it was a nice place where you met your spouse 30 or 40 years ago, or where your grandma or your grandfather graduated from, you know, the chances are that it's not your grandfather's Christian college. So, you know, be real careful about finding out what they teach there. And if they're teaching a quote-unquote social justice, which you find out is less classic Christian social justice as it was originally intended and more of a kind of modern-day secular progressive socialism, well, that's not good. And you'll want to ask people. You want to say, hey, tour guide, okay, social justice, right? You know, what does that mean? What does
right.
that mean? Right? Crucifixes in the classroom? Are they there? Are they not there? You know, what's going on with that? Do your professors do they have to have a statement affirming faith? You know, what does that statement mean? So these are the kind of things that people ought to be asking.
Mm-hmm. And there is also an anti-capitalist sentiment, it seems, and that noise is getting louder. So if you would speak to that, Paul.
Well, that's right. And in fact, I'll even back up a little bit, Bill, here and just, you know, let people know that socialism and democratic socialism, which is what you hear from young people nowadays, will say, "Well, I'm not a communist, right? I'm a socialist, or I'm a democratic socialist." Well, what they need to understand is that in Marxist theory, going back to the Communist Manifesto, going back to what became Marxism-Leninism, Lenin's interpretation of Marxism, socialism is simply one stage. It's next to the last stage on the way to communism. So the so-called Marxist dialectic of history would be that people would evolve. They would pass through these various stages of development. You'd go from feudalism to capitalism to socialism to communism. That was the plan. That was the idea. My friend Marion Smith at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, Bill, he likes to say Christians go to heaven, socialists go to communism, because you know that according to the stage, the stages, and what they aspire to, that is indeed for socialists the next stage. It's full communism. And I like that analogy by Marion even more, because when you read Marx and you read Marxism-Leninism, that final stage of communism is described in religious-like language as a kind of utopia.
Mm-hmm.
So as a kind of secular, godless, unchristian, non-Christian, anti-Christian utopia. So that's what they aspire to. And I teach this stuff, right? I actually teach a course at Grove City College called Marxism. We meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And just yesterday we were reading Engels. Engels was the co-author with Marx on the Communist Manifesto. We were reading his Principles of Communism. And he ends there listing three different types of socialism. And the last type of socialism that he lists is democratic socialism. So democratic socialism wasn't exactly the same as communism, and it still isn't today. But if you go to the website of the Democratic Socialists of America, which is the thing that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a member of,
mm-hmm.
that Ilhan Omar is a member of, Rashida Tlaib, these are all new members of the Democratic Party. It says there the Democratic Socialists of America is, quote, the largest socialist organization in the United States. That's an exact quote. So you know, those Democratic Socialists there consider themselves socialists. So here again, it's incumbent upon us to say to these folks, all right, well, you call yourself a democratic socialist. Tell me how that's different from what Marx wanted, what Bernie wants, you know, what Lenin wanted, what Engels wanted. And if they don't know, Well, they should know, especially when ideas that they push, like this Green New Deal, look much more like economic socialism than they do environmentalism.
Paul, wouldn't they be inclined to just write you off as a crazy professor when you ask them to differentiate?
Well, they might, but I mean, they shouldn't, right?
I agree, they shouldn't.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that we should demand. I wrote a piece for American Spectator last week for the occasion of International Women's Day,
mm-hmm.
and I laid out there what I've known for a long time, that International Women's Day was founded by Clara Zetkin, who was a German Marxist socialist radical feminist. She died over 80 years ago. She's buried in the wall of the Kremlin. and the day was picked up by Lenin and the Bolsheviks, and they made it a national holiday. So International Women's Day was a national holiday in the Soviet Union. You know, now in the United States, you go to Google every March 8th, and the little Google thing that pops up wishes you a happy International Women's Day. So you know, here in America, we're secularizing Christmas. We're secularizing Easter. Valentine's Day is no longer St. Valentine's Day. St. Patrick's Day is a day to get drunk. And now all of a sudden they're taking a literal communist holiday, which was as secular and atheistic as you can imagine, Bill, and people in the United States, it's a groundswell to make this some sort of a national day in the United States. And when people like me point this out, we're made fun of, right? It's like, oh, come on, you know, who are you, Joe McCarthy? No, I'm pointing out something you ought to know. These are fruits from a poison tree,
right?
Yeah. But they don't. And yet in they'll go into the past of somebody to find out. Speaking of drinking, right? Whether Brett Kavanaugh drank too much in high school, whether somebody in their yearbook has some offensive photos, right? Governor Northam, whether or not he ever wore blackface. By the way, none of which I support. But the point is, they happily go into the past all the time, not only to expose things, but to ruin people's lives. And when we want to go into the past to say, don't go down the road of socialism or communism, they start making fun of us. So it's troubling.
Yeah, it is. My guest is Dr. Paul Kingor, and he's written a book called Communism, the Killingest Idea Ever. We'll take a little break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Paul Kingor. This is Dr. Paul Kingor, and he's written a book called Communism, the Killingest Idea Ever. So he is an expert on this subject. When I look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when she makes a statement that capitalism is irredeemable, what do you make of that, Paul?
Well, that's amazing. It's an amazing statement, and I would object not only to the phrase irredeemable, the word irredeemable used there with capitalism, but really even the phrase of capitalism, which in a way shows what an ideologue she is, because you know, capitalism, that was the preferred language of Marx and Engels and others, and not only them, right? But what Marx and Engels and those folks did was they took what largely had existed throughout all of time as something called free markets, people owning private property, the Judeo-Christian notion, thou shalt not steal, that people have the right to property, that they have the right to exchange, that they have the right to commerce, that you have the right to buy property from somebody, and then when you own that property, to work it and till it and grow fruit and vegetables from it, and sell it or barter it, or go rent yourself as labor to someone who owns a coal mine or someone who owns a factory. So throughout a lot of time, that's been the simple free exchange of goods in a free marketplace. And then to come along and kind of vilify it as an ism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism.
Right.
If you look at it, they didn't even object to a lot of that stuff throughout history until the Industrial Revolution, when you saw a lot of the vagaries of what was going on at that time with companies, with factories. By the way, which, Bill, as you know and I know because we're descendants of people who worked in the coal mines and factories and everything else, you weren't a slave. You weren't forced to work in those places. You didn't have to work in those places. But she wants to describe – that's kind of what she means as capitalism, right, this dark, evil, nefarious thing out there. But as the guy – what's his first name? Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks.
Yeah, Howard.
Running for president.
Yeah.
Yeah. He'll be the first to tell you, look, I mean, I open all these coffee shops all around the country. I'm born and raised in Brooklyn. I'm a self-made man. My employees get good benefits. They get health care. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can go there and have a coffee with a latte made up of milk from cows that she wants to ban, right? What did I do wrong, right? What's so bad about it? Is that capitalism?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times they don't really even think. I think of the logic or the full implications of what it is that they're saying.
Yeah, Paul, do you think it'd be a wise idea to have the Arnold Kengort tours to Venezuela to give people a little sample of what it's like?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I'll nominate you to go on those, and I'll stay.
Yeah,
I'll stay at home. But it might not be. Maybe even a better idea would be to have the Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, oh, I agree.
Tour
to that.
Of Venezuela, and for them to, you know, hop on an airplane and go down there and take a look and see how she really feels about this place when she finds out that she can't get toilet paper.
Uh-huh.
Right? When she finds out that her car has stalled out because the country's sitting on the largest oil reserves in the Western Hemisphere, in South America, in Latin America. You know, people can't even get oil, can't even get gasoline. I mean, granted, toilet paper doesn't grow from the ground in Venezuela, but oil does.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe they had to go down there. Then when they're done on their way up, you know, detour a little bit west and hit Cuba, where they could get a glance at the greatness of the revolution there as well.
Yeah. Now, Paul, if you would talk as a compassionate Christian, because you know there's people that respond when I have stories like this on the station, and they are, you know, they're questioning what Jesus would be today. Would he be a capitalist? Would he be a socialist? And, you know, we all want to take care of our neighbors and love people where they're at and reach out to them in Christian kindness. So how do we put this all into that equation?
Well, it's a great question. And something that really bothers me is when they say that, you know, the Bible defends socialism or the Bible defends communism. Actually, Karl Marx said communism begins where atheism begins.
Hmm.
Lenin said there's nothing more abominable than religion. He said, all worship of a divinity is a necrophilia. Those guys hated religion. So and so people, listen carefully to this. Just because the Bible talks about sharing things and helping your fellow man, which is what communism, socialism also talks about doing, doesn't mean that the Bible supports communism and socialism, right? I mean, almost any worthy philosophy of humanity out there talks about the golden rule or helping and sharing. I mean, Christianity talks about charity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Helping people. So just because, you know, you could check off two things in the box of 100 things that communists do and say, well, they also want to share, that doesn't thereby mean that the Bible and communism are the same thing. Not at all. In fact, it's the complete antithesis of it. And also, too, you see very clearly throughout the scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament, the defense of private property. I mean, it's all through there. Look at some of Jesus's parables. from the talents to the vineyard. He talks again and again. He really defends property rights,
mm-hmm.
And he, even the case of the Good Samaritan. You know, there he is, and he helps this Samaritan. He takes him to the inn. He tells the innkeeper. He doesn't stop and say, look around at everybody and say, hey, this guy needs help. Where's the government, right? Come on, where's everybody to help this guy out?
Mm-hmm.
He picks him up, puts him on his horse, donkey, takes him to the inn. This is private initiative,
mm-hmm.
right?
Good point.
Tells the innkeeper, here's some money to take care of him for the next few days, and you know what? I'm going to come back and I'm going to check on him. I'm going to make sure you use my money the right way. And then he comes back and he checks on him. I mean, that's not socialism, right? That's not communism. That's a person acting of their own free will and their own compassion. So, you know, there are many ways for Christians to help people without resorting to a socialism or communism that's inherently atheistic and even anti-religious.
Mm-hmm. Paul, when you obviously you teach at a Christian college, and so you've got access to all kinds of younger minds, and what do you see them, how are they thinking in terms of embracing some of the ideas that they're hearing in the culture and then mixing it with what you're teaching them?
Well, Grove City College, I suppose, is a little different because we get students who are largely conservative to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But around the country, it's pretty grim, and you know, we're looking at survey data. A breakthrough year was around 2012, according to Gallup, and this had been a few years into the Obama presidency. Every year, they would ask young people, "Do you prefer socialism or capitalism?" And capitalism barely edged it out. But that year, they said socialism over capitalism. I think it was like 44% to 42%, and the number keeps widening. So it continues to get worse. And there was also a study done in 2015 by Reason and the Roop Foundation, which asked young people if they'd consider voting for a socialist for president of the United States, and 69% said they would.
Wow.
And a lot of people thought, well, I wouldn't really do that. Well, a year after that, Bernie Sanders, a lifetime socialist, a Trotskyist,
mm-hmm.
in his youth, an actual formal presidential elector to the Socialist Workers Party in 1980, Bernie Sanders got 13 million votes in the Democratic primary. And to give you an idea of how many that is, Donald Trump got 14 million in the Republican primary.
Wow.
13 million votes, Sanders, he got over 40% of the Democratic Party votes. And if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was old enough to run in 2020, she'd probably get a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very real threat. It's a very real problem.
With Bernie gaining a lot of momentum right now, do you think that he is the top contender right now on the Democratic side?
Well, I'd have to say that he is because, you know, typically, as you know, Bill, in election cycles, whoever was the runner-up for the nomination 4 years earlier is usually considered the front-runner.
Mm-hmm.
The next time around, it would be whether it be a John McCain, right, a Mitt Romney. And in this case, with the front-runner, Hillary Clinton, not going to run in 2020, I don't think, and Bernie having said
that
he's going to run. Yeah, I guess we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine that she would. But anyway, Bernie has said that he's going to run, which – at this point would make him the effective front runner who's thrown his hat in the ring. And also too, I understand that Bernie represented sort of the non-Hillary vote,
mm-hmm.
in 2016. But if he ends up in a crowd of 16 different Democrats, kind of like Donald Trump in a crowd of 16 Republicans, and Trump kept getting 20% of the vote, and all the other guys, Jeb Bush and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and John Kasich and Chris Christie, Carly Farina, all of them splitting the other three quarters. That's how Trump ended up with the Republican nomination. And Bernie's got a pretty committed 20% to 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very real possibility.
Yeah.
And besides, I don't know who else their front runner would be in 2020. I can't name the person right now.
Will Joe Biden take the lead if he gets in it?
Maybe. But I don't think Joe Biden excites people. Mm-hmm. I really don't.
Yeah.
And right there, if we're falling back to Joe Biden, it just kind of shows the depths of desperation for the Democrats.
You always make me laugh. Paul, how should my listeners best be in touch with you? Certainly go to Amazon, and your last name is spelled K-E-N-G-O-R, and look at any of all and all of your books. Is there also a blog you write, or what is another way to keep track of you?
Yeah, that would work. And I wrote The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism,
yes,
which deals with a lot of this stuff, including issues like 21st century socialism. Our website is the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a weekly column for the American Spectator as well.
That's awesome. And Paul, you are always one of my very favorite guests to speak to. Thank you so much for saying yes to my invitation and coming on and being just a great friend of Faith Radio.
Oh, well, thank you, Bill, and I'm happy to come back anytime. That was too long. Let's do it again.
Yeah, all right.
Too long since the last time I came on.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Paul Kengor has been my guest. You can go find out lots more about him and go to Amazon.com and see all of his books. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
I'm Neil Stavem. I talked recently with a listener who gave a gift in appreciation of the family-focused teaching available every day here on Faith Radio. He understood that affirming and strengthening marriages and families can eliminate a host of social problems and bring about transformation in a culture. His gift helps keep programs like Focus on the Family and Family Life Today coming your way, sharing the biblical blueprint for relationships. Have you been blessed, encouraged, and equipped through the family-focused teaching on Faith Radio? Well, join with this listener and many others to invest in keeping God's Word and His design for the family available on air, online, or on the app, so individuals, homes, and communities can be strengthened to connect their faith to life every day. You can give a gift anytime online at myfaithradio.com or by calling 877-93-FAITH. Relevant Bible preaching, family-focused teaching, connecting faith to life every day. That's the mission and ministry of Faith Radio.
Big thanks to Nate Pyle and Dr. Paul Kengor. He's written many books. He wrote a book on the Pope and President Reagan. He's written a book on communism. He's an extremely bright guy from Grove City College. He's a professor there. We'll take a short break. We'll be back with lots more in hour two.